Thanks, Eric.
Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, tracking Storm Bert in Cork and Galway, a tale of two farms in one in Carlow, and TV's original Mean Girl and a senior hurler connect in Kilkenny. Well, no sooner than I said last week that I thought that that would be the last programme with a bit of an autumnal vibe to it, than winter goes and kicks down the front door and announces, I am here with a vengeance. Yesterday, there was snow all over Achill Island, right the way down to the beach. And today, well, let's find out what Storm Bert has been doing. John O'Sullivan, good morning. How are you?
Doing well, Hi. Philip. How are you?
You're farming just outside Uachtarard. Organic sheep, blueberries, aronia, berries. I'd say you've had a bit of a week of it.
It's been an interesting one. Quite the adventure, Philip. I suppose the biggest concern really was it was quite unusual, the amount of snow and the way in which it came. And basically, sheep did okay, but struggled to get access to any vegetation. So all they could really get was bits of conifers and tops of rushes and so on. So we had to feed them outside. But what was really unusual was, I suppose, yesterday, because of the rain on Thursday night, there was a sheet of ice over the snow. So sheep found it very hard. They wouldn't actually come to their feed on the side of the roads because the ice was so sharp and hurting their legs and shins. So it meant practically walking to every group of sheep to provide them some feed to literally serve them at their table, as opposed to have them walk across terrain to you.
I would imagine, though, that most of that snow and ice has now been swept away.
It's all gone. It's a very different looking scene this morning, for sure.
And is everything all right? Not so much rain as to cause problems, or what's happened?
Looking at things yesterday, the red warning and 40 mils through the night with up to 8.7 mils in 1 hour, which would be absolutely torrential around here. It looked a lot worse than it actually was. And storm damage, not so bad either. So it's the usual, you know, branches, trees, that type of stuff, but nothing as major as we had anticipated.
Just a few sheep left with some sore or scraped shins.
That's exactly right, yeah. But I suppose it really just demonstrates how we need to, I suppose, maybe think of it differently. The weather patterns are changing, let's just say, very significantly. And just saying to my wife last night that if the sheep hadn't been collected for breeding, they'd been up on a much, let's just say, higher elevation with a lot more scope and so on. So getting to them would have been very, very difficult. Yeah, we're very fortunate about the timing and the extent.
Okay. In Cork, the other red alert county, Mary Curtin, is standing by. Good morning, Mary. How are you?
Good morning. All good. How are you?
You're farming sucklers with your dad. Now, you got them all in, but I can't imagine that they're going to be going back out again anytime soon.
No, but I said it had been a time of year anyway, so I think we're okay with that. We're content with it.
And how wet is it this morning?
It's not bad. So I'm actually in North Cork, so we didn't get it as bad as I'd say anticipated. It was more the snow did damage to us rather than the rain.
Same thing with you again. Okay. This wet weather now. Last year, the third stormiest year on record, and the other two have come within the last 10 years. Has it changed the way that you and your dad farm much?
Well, I'd say the winters are definitely longer. Like, you have to prepare for it in terms of the fodder budget. So around here, we would have a slightly longer winter on average, and maybe other farmers in the country anyway, just given our location. But I think it's more that you kind of have to expect that you might have to go in earlier because of a bad fall or stay in longer because of a bad spring. Mm-hmm. So it's just more being prepared.
Time was when a winter was officially a 2 month thing. How long are you budgeting for winter being now? 4 months, 5 months?
You'd have to budget for six, definitely. Just to be sure, just to have a safety net, just to make sure that if anything does go wrong, you still have something.
That just around the corner from the South Pole Inn in Annascaul, County Kerry, we'll find Sean McCarthy. Good morning, Sean. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
You're milking, or at least you're trying to milk this morning. How was it last night?
Not as bad as we expected. We got 18 mil So we expected a lot worse. It's not bad this morning now, and there doesn't seem to be any structural damage or a bit of surface water here and there, so not so bad. Thanks be to God.
Well, isn't that mad that 8.7 mil would be a bit of a disaster for John in Uachtaráid, but 18 mil you can weather in Kerry without that much of a problem?
Yeah, we're of high ground. It flows off fast, gets out to sea very fast around here.
A lot of snow during the week as well?
Yeah, we got a surprise there Thursday morning. We were to get snow, and then the forecast changed a little that we weren't, and then it started snowing very heavy around 7 a.m. and kept going for a good while. So it was challenging for a few hours.
And what does challenging mean? I mean, what do you have to do different?
Well, dairy cows, they never went out. The milking cows never went out that day. That was pretty much the end of grazing. And young stock in calf heifers, they had to come in. And younger stock that were further away, we had to get extra feed out to them in the lines of meal to keep them going, because they couldn't get access to the grass.
So, you heard Mary say there that winter is now a six-month affair, or at least in terms of budgeting the fodder. How long do you budget for in Kerry?
We're always 6 months. Yeah, we're always 6 months. We've long winters here.
And how do you cope with that? Is it a choice between going and scouting around the place for extra fodder or extra feed if you have to, or would you reduce your cull cows over the winter?
We'd reduce the cull cows, a bit of both. We're fortunate enough to be able to pick up dry cow silage from beef farmers that when they get into surplus grass, we're able to buy extra for them and things like that. So a bit of both.
All right. Well, look, it seems that most people have weathered things well, and hopefully that continues to be the case, and that those waters where they are flooding, because we've heard some reports in Clifton, at least, of a number of houses being flooded, but hopefully those waters are receding now without having done too much damage. Sean, John and Mary, thank you all very much. So weather obviously bringing with it a whole new set of challenges. I had a very chilly farm visit in Carlow during the week to an organic farm, because we wanted to take a look this week at why it is that homegrown organic foods aren't having more of a moment. Why, after all of the years of supports and tender loving care, aren't our shelves awash with organic options that do not cost the earth? So I went to meet a man with two organic businesses on the one farm. Joe Nolan, near Ballon in Carlow, runs both organic sheep and tillage operations. But it is very much a tale of two farms. The organic cereal business doing quite well, the organic lamb not firing on all cylinders. Joe is also a former banker, so I was hoping for a bit of insight into what organic needs to do to be less niche. Wow. 2 degrees above zero and raining. This is what you got into farming for, wasn't it?
Absolutely. That's why I left the office job for.
What was the reason you got out of financial services and into this?
I always wanted to go back farming. Work for myself as well. You have your own time. Uh-huh. That's a big part of it.
So explain the farm to me now. Two businesses in the one.
Yeah, so farming about 250 acres. At the moment we have 80 acres of tillage. So I went back into tillage when I went organic, so in 2022. So this was our third harvest. And the rest of the farm then is in grass, running about 600 ewes. Okay. So killing maybe close to 900,000 lambs a year.
And was the idea of going into tillage that you'd be able to feed yourself?
Yeah, so originally the idea was to be self-sufficient on feed. Feed was a big focus for me when I went organic. I wanted to be able to source reasonably priced organic feed, which is difficult, or was difficult. It's still difficult. So I made the decision when I decided to go organic that I would be self-sufficient food-wise.
And now, irony of ironies, the tillage side of the business is enjoying boisterous good prospects, but the sheep side is languishing somewhat.
Yeah, now sheep are good price, but like sheep are lamb is an expensive meat to produce. There's no comparison. It's the tillage is miles ahead.
Night and day.
Night and day.
Are people asking you, why are you not just putting the whole thing into tillage?
Well, yeah, someone asked me that recently, but you need the animals because we can't spread fertiliser. So you have to have a balance. It's all about a balance in organic farming. Like full 100% organic tillage farms are very rare. There's actually less than 40, I think, in the country. So it's normally a mix of animals and crops, because we need the animals to grow the crops and we need the crops to feed the animals. So there's a balance there. Well, on the lamb side, you go into supermarkets in Ireland or anywhere, you're going to struggle to find organic lamb. It's a tough one because you have to fill the market to go chasing markets as well, but there isn't been the push on the lamb that has been on the tillage side.
It's not just about shelf space, though. That's about marketing. Like,
yeah.
I really can't recall the last time I saw anybody pushing me to buy organic lamb.
Yeah, no, neither have I.
By contrast, I'm being sold organic porridge oats all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of the organic lamb goes into like baby food markets. So, you know, onto the continent for baby food markets. Mm-hmm. But very little of it at the moment is finding its way onto the shelves. Yeah.
Of course, there are many other factors at work here. But is that the key thing, that we just haven't developed Irish people's taste or grow for the idea of organic lamb in the way that we have for cereals?
Yeah, probably. And vegetables. So, like, vegetables are very noticeable recently. And we buy organic vegetables, and we do buy them off a local farmer, but when they're out of season, you can get them in the supermarket now. But there isn't that push on meat.
It's not going to stop raining until March.
Don't say that. It'll be a long winter. You're watching a lot of Netflix.
So what's this cover crop?
So this is a mixture of double turnip, vetch, some black oats. It looks good.
It does look very good. It's in rude good health. Yeah. Everything here.
Yeah,
isn't
great
it?
Colour and everything on it.
So this is the side of the business that is really taking off then.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the difference? What's the key ingredient that separates this from the sheep?
Better market with more options. You know, I have the option of selling to farmers for feed, even on the oat side. I have a couple of different places I can sell oats to for porridge or for, you know, for processing.
So Flatlands in the south, whites in the north.
Whites in the north. I only have one option with the lambs, really, organically.
So it's just a better developed market.
Market, yeah.
That has more marketing of its own produce.
Of its own produce. And look, oats is a superfood. It's come back into fashion as well, which helps.
Lamb is not a bad food.
No, lamb is a very healthy food, a very good food, simple food, tasty food. But it's
underappreciated.
Underappreciated. It's seen as expensive, which it isn't. So it's just a perception on it as well.
Well, maybe you all need to stop talking about what a great price you're getting for your lamb.
It's not bad at the moment.
Talk to me about the level of support. Are they sufficient?
Yeah, like when I went... Hang
on a second, will I just pick my head up off the ground? Farmer says supports are sufficient.
Yeah, well, they're never sufficient, but they're decent, I would say. My organic payment here is the same as my single farm payment. So my BIS and my eco scheme. So like that's, to me, is a pretty good payment. But it's not all about payments, it's also about support. So, you know, you want research, you want... organic farmers are very open to discussions, to passing knowledge on, all of that. We have a solar farm running down the road.
For something that is just sitting in a shed... With that amount of rain and damp outside, it's really very, very dry, isn't it?
Yeah, we actually got tested last week. We got the results on Monday, yesterday. I only got the results and it's 89% dry matter.
Are you proud of this?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, for somebody who's really only gotten into tillage yesterday,
yeah,
this represents quite an achievement, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's good. Now, the tillage size is definitely ahead of where I ever expected it to be.
Mm-hmm.
As I said earlier, I always remember saying to a friend of mine, I'm going to have 5 hectares of tillage, and he said 50. And I'm not too far off 50 next year.
Yet I still get the impression from you that you feel that the whole organic sector is only operating at about 50 or 60% of what it could.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's very positive. Like, you go to anything to do with organic farming, it's always positive. You know, anyone that's coming from a conventional background, when you're used to, you know, fighting for price, you know, you know, it's hard to make money at farming.
Different kind of energy
in
the room.
It's a different kind of energy in the room. And you'll see that written by a lot of big farmers, a lot of very well-known farmers went organic last year, and you'll see them writing in different places and different things, and they all say the same thing, that energy is very positive on the organic side. Like, there's things that need to be done, but a lot of that is due to the fantastic growth in organic farming over the last few years. Like, it takes time, and it will get there. Like, as I said, Chagas have rolled in, Department have rolled in. We probably need a little bit more from Borbia locally. You know, probably need a mill somewhere. You know, we just need to connect up the dots a bit.
But you don't need the government to start making active interventions in the market, you think?
No, I don't think so. I think the market's there. Like, I suppose that's probably the banker in me, but, like, the market will sort it out, and people want organic. You know, as we said, like, you know, you can see people, organic baby food on the continent is a huge market. There's huge markets out there. People want organic. And if people want organic, we'll supply it.
Reaction already to Joe Nolan there in Carlow from Carl in Meath on 0870 32 32 32, our WhatsApp line. Philip, listening to that, organic farmer is a breath of fresh air, not complaining and saying that he is doing all right. More power to him. Well, science has made the case for organics. More farms than ever are making that switch, but we are still some way from organic produce being the norm and not niche. So, what next then? Porrig Brennan is the chairperson of the Organic Strategy Forum. Good morning to you, Porrig.
Good morning, Philip.
Before we look at the problems here, it's probably important to acknowledge what Joe Nolan said there about what was working. Things like the knowledge support from Chagas, support and camaraderie within the sector, and knock me down with a feather, the financial supports were enough, he said, or almost sufficient.
Well, we have recorded now, I know, Philip, that he said that, so. there's lots of positives there, I think, and it's I think, as your caller said, or the texter said, it's great to see you're such positivity, really. And I think it's, you know, Joe is a reflection maybe of the momentum that we've seen in the sector over the last couple of years. You know, we've seen an extra, 3,000 farmers come into organic farming over the last 2 years. We've seen a trebling of the area that's been farmed organically, albeit from a small base, Philip, but it's wonderful to see that sort of momentum starting to come into the sector.
Trebling of the area, but how close are we to the target of 10% of farmed land under organics?
Well, to put it this way, we're at 5% today, Philip. We were at 2% 2.5 years ago, or thereabouts. So we have another 5% to find between now and 2030. But I think if we can build on the momentum that's there, we're in a good place to get there. But there's a lot of work required in the meantime. And I suppose from my point of view, as chairman of the Organic Strategy Forum, is trying to see, well, where can we help? What are the things we can do to actively make a difference, whether it's from a support point of view, a market development point of view, or skills and a kind of a technical knowledge perspective. They're the areas, I think, that we need to look at, and look at probably differently depending on the product that you're talking about as well.
We are, though, it would seem, missing some key pieces of infrastructure here. Just picking up on what Joe was saying, in the case of sheep, an organic cereal mill somewhere in the country would be a good idea so that we could reduce the reliance on imported organic feed and more organic slaughtering lines. What could or should the state be doing here?
Well, I think you look at the lamb side of things, in some ways, there's a couple of factors at play. Number one, and I think it was alluded to in your report, that lamb prices are positive. Whether it's conventional or organic lamb prices, they're positive. I think they're up about 15 or 20% this year. And if I'm selling organic lamb this week, I'm probably making about 15 euro per head more than the conventional equivalent. So there is a premium there for organic lamb. But the big issue we have in terms of that market development piece, there's probably a twin track element here. Number one, we don't have enough consistency of supply when it comes to organic lamb. We have a situation where over the last 2 years, the one major organic lamb processor that we have in the country would tell you they've had more customers looking for lamb than they've been able to supply over the last 2 years, because those customers are interested, but they're only interested if you can guarantee them consistency of supply for a large chunk of the year. And we have a situation at the moment, Philip, where of all the organic lambs that are being reared across the country, about 7 in 10 of those are ending up going into the conventional sector throughout their lifetime at some stage.
Well, so that's, we're just the greatest waste, isn't it? Why is that happening? Is it the absence of cheap and available organic feed west of the Shannon?
Yeah. No, I think I'd say what it is for me, it's a loss of value. It's a loss of value for the farmer, number one, in terms of that 15 euro per lamb or whatever it might be at a given point of time, which I think every single farmer wants to get the best price they possibly can. And it's a loss from a processor and a market development point of view as well. But there's a couple of factors at play. If you look where the organic sheep farms are, Philip, a lot of them are in the west of Ireland. A lot of those farmers are in a position to produce store lambs maybe, but not necessarily have the facilities or the land, if you like, to finish those lambs. So in a conventional situation, what you do is you'd sell your store lamb, go down to the local market or sell it to a local farmer, whatever it is. When it comes to organic, it's not as straightforward. There's not an obvious route to find that farmer who's going to finish that lamb to keep it in the organic system, if you like. So we really have a lot of work to do in terms of coordinating that supply base. And the other thing then is, the one major processor that we have from a lamb point of view is obviously in the eastern part of the country. It's a long way from the west to the east. Ideally,
not necessarily worth the journey. No, I understand. Can I move us on to the milk sector, please?
Yeah.
Your ambition is to be producing 40 million litres of organic milk a year by 2030. Now, that sounds like an impressive figure. But on the island of Ireland, we produce 5 billion litres of milk annually.
That's correct, yeah.
Why is the uptake in dairy so comparatively low?
Yeah, well, I suppose we need to look at this one from a couple of angles as well. Unfortunately, when it comes to organic, there's always a number of elements at play. But if you look at it from a farmer point of view, first of all, when it comes to organic dairy or milk production, number one, you look at conventional milk prices over the last 5 or 10 years on average have been pretty strong. You look at an organic milk production system, it's viewed as a high cost production system because that's reflecting the fact that most organic milk is going in either liquid milk or products like yogurt that require year-round supply. So it's a more costly, it's a more labour-requiring production system, if you like. And for farmers, they're not convinced they can make the return from that compared to producing as much milk as possible off grass. If I'm a processor, I suppose I'm looking at it then, right, there's a small number of dairy farmers in the country. There's a lot of distance between those dairy farmers at times. So it can be a high-cost milk collection, high cost to process small volumes of milk. And I suppose really, for me on the dairy side, what we need to find is how do we add value to the milk that's being produced, whether it's in cheese or butter or powders or whatever it is, and how can more of that milk be produced, if you like, along the seasonal grass growth curve as much as possible. That'll help reduce production costs, reduce labour requirements during the winter for farmers. And then I think if you can get to that point, Philip, then organic milk production becomes a slightly more realistic option.
Does that mean that organic needs? Does that mean that organic needs to concentrate on cheese and butter and forget about the pint of organic milk on the table?
I think there'll always be a requirement for organic milk because it's nearly one of the entry products. But I think it can't be all organic milk. We have to look at how we can add value to as much of that milk as possible through other products as well, because they're products that you can. The farmer can produce the milk in the summer off grass, lower cost production system, and you have product then that's consistently available throughout 12 months of the year. So I think we just need to look at what we do there.
So final big picture question here then, Padraig.
Yeah.
Look, notwithstanding all of the achievements and the measurements that you say go to give you a really good impression of where organics is going, 80% of farmland in the country is under grass. So until we crack these problems with dairy and sheep and to a lesser extent with beef, the organic sector is not really doing what it is supposed to be doing, is it, in terms of environmental restoration?
Well, I think we're on the right track, Philip, first of all, in terms of the momentum that's there. And I think when you hear the enthusiasm from the likes of Joe earlier on in your report, it's fantastic to see. And it's great to see farmers like that involved in the sector. I think we have a job to do when it comes to dairy or beef or sheep, and whether that's grow the supply base, better coordinate the supply base, to make sure we're not losing animals out of the system, whatever it is, we absolutely have to focus on that. That's going to require more producer groups, better funding for coordination of that supply base. All of those things have to be done. But I nearly bring it back to the marketplace here a little bit as well. The really good news is there is a market for organic food. There's a growing market for organic food here in Ireland and certainly across Europe. I think that's a good starting point. The other thing is, if I'm an organic farmer, and you heard it in the report this morning, it's not all about grass. There's a rotation in your system as well, whether it's to tillage or to combi crops or whatever it is. So I think we need to see how do we use the land base that's there, that's being farmed organically, to produce as many products as we can, whether that's a feed input to rear the animals, whether it's a tillage enterprise to grow the oats for a Flavins or whoever it might be. That's what we need to get right. So we have a land base that's producing a really good range of high quality organic products. We're aiming for 10% of land by 2030. I think we have a job of work to do to get there, but with the enthusiasm that's there, if we can continue to put the supports in place that have been put in place, I think we have momentum to try and get us there. It's not going to be easy. There's no point in saying it is, but I think we have the building blocks to work from.
Indeed. Padraig Brennan, chairperson of the Organic Strategy Forum, thank you very much for that. And so many of your texts this morning on 51551 are playing testament to that enthusiasm. Frank says, Joe the farmer has given me a good start to the day, happy and positive. Great to hear a farmer not complaining. Have a good day, everybody. And John in Mayo wants to remind everybody to mention that the Organic Farming Scheme is taking new applications, closing date the 29th of November. That is next Friday. I don't need to remind people because you've just done that for me, John. Thank you very much. Coming up after the break, A Mean Girl and Brenda Donoghue.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
If you are over the age of 45, that has probably created a picture in your mind of little Laura Ingalls running down a meadowed hill. Little House on the Prairie. Essential TV from a time, well, when there wasn't really a whole lot going on TV. Entire episodes, I seem to remember, devoted to the time that Mary got mumps, or when a coyote stole a hen, or real drama when Laura was, 5 minutes late for school one day. The character, though, that we all remember was television's first mean girl, the original of the species, Nellie Olson. Now, we got wind on Countrywide that the actress who played Nellie Olson, Alison Arngrim, was in Ireland this week to trace her Irish roots in County Kilkenny. So we sent our own goody two-shoes, Brenda Donoghue, to track down the spoiled brat that a generation loved to hate. Brenda, in 1970s, 1980s Ireland, every school playground had a bunch of Lauras and one or two Nellies. I think you were probably a Laura.
We straight away, I will say the simple answer to that question is yes, I was a Laura. But I'm kind of annoyed immediately, Philip. I'm very annoyed.
Yeah, I can see you're annoyed.
And I have
you have your annoyed face on you.
I do, yeah. You said goody two-shoes, Laura, which shows that you don't understand the fundamental basis of her character and what was appealing about her on Little House on the Prairie. Because Laura was adventurous. She was plucky. She was a tomboy. She was spirited. She fought bullies. And she fought the greatest bully of them all, which was Nellie Olson.
Okay. Despite my problems with the fact that nothing ever happened in any episode of Little House on the Prairie.
Wrong.
No, this is the hill on which I will stand.
Okay.
An entire episode devoted to her losing the egg somewhere between the hen house and the kitchen is not high powered drama. But let us just set that aside.
No, for a moment. I will 100% take issue with you there.
Oh, God.
Because what you do not understand is when this started in 1974, when the first episode aired, and it went on till 1980. 83. We as viewers,
there
it was
were simpler
all we
times,
had.
Simpler times.
Simpler now. Times.
Less demanding television
less
audiences.
But we followed the Ingalls family who live on Plum Creek near Walnut Grove. Charles, Mum Caroline, Laura, Mary and baby Carrie. And we were connected deeply with them.
We were, because what I'm going to go on to say is that in spite of not an awful lot happening in each episode, I do remember bristling at the injustice of somebody like Nellie Olson being allowed to exist and getting away with being such a spoiled brat and a mean girl.
Well, there are episodes actually tackled deeper issues of racism, drug addiction, as well as all those simpler things about losing a coyote or whatever.
Getting molasses in your hair.
It actually did, and faith and community spirit. It was all of those things. But I know when I was growing up, I really was Laura. I mean, I used to believe I was. And without going into too many details, but there was a girl who had similar traits to Nellie Olson. And we both auditioned for a similar part.
Don't name her
in a
now.
Local show. I'm not saying anything.
Who got the part?
She did.
Of course she did, because it's an unjust world.
It is an unjust world. And can I give you one quote? This is one of my favourite Laura quotes, okay? When bully Nellie Olson tries to ridicule her, Laura tells her, "Hard-working folks only smell bad to people who have nothing better to do than stick their noses in the air." She was feisty.
So poor old Alison Arngrim probably didn't realise that she was needing armed protection and bodyguards arriving in this country to trace her roots, did she?
Well, let's begin with our story of our meeting. So it was last Monday. It was a day a bit like today, although the rain wasn't as intense, but it was wet, it was grey. And we went into this beacon of light, a pub in the village called Shawnee's Bar. And Alison was there. And she was in Ireland correctly to trace her roots, because she has ancestors there and they had led her to Tullerone in Kilkenny. But also she was there to speak at a social media fest. So she was here for a couple of reasons. So I went down and I met her. And honestly, I mean, I don't want to name drop or anything like that, but like, I would have interviewed David Beckham, Jennifer Anderson. Pamela Anderson. Yeah. Sorry, I'm getting worked up. Can you see what she means to me? But meeting Alison and Nellie Olson, so much of my whole formative life, and I'm sure for many, many listeners, it's the same kind of thing. It was actually a big deal.
Do you know what it is? Share those memories now. 0870 32 32 32 is the WhatsApp line. Go on.
Okay, so, I mean, she wanted to talk about her family roots and all the rest, but I had no interest at the time. All I wanted to talk about was her ringlets. So, I mean, we got talking and I straight away went into Nellie Olson and I asked her at age 12, Alison, how did you actually become Nellie Olson?
Here's the crazy thing. When I auditioned for the part, I hadn't read the books. I had no clue. I hadn't read the Laura Ingalls Wilder books. I didn't know there was a Nellie Olson. I don't think I knew there was a Laura Ingalls. I had no clue. And I had read for the part of Laura and for the part of Mary when they made the pilot. And I didn't get those. And so I get called back. And I get those pages. And I turned to my father, who was sitting next to me, and said, "This is not a normal part. She's awful." And he said, "What are you talking about?" Well, when I read it for him, he was in hysterics, said, "Don't change a thing, you go do it like that." And I did. And you know, I was hired on the spot. They just went nuts. And right away I did. I said, "Oh wow, she's the villain." And I've always liked villain roles. I love villains. And so I was very happy about it. I went, "Yes, she's really terrible and I'm going to enjoy doing this."
I wonder when you put on the costume and the hair was kind of wrapped around your ear and ringlets.
Yeah.
Did you suddenly become the character? Because the costumes were so iconic.
Absolutely.
Really.
It's like Jack Nicholson said when he was playing the Joker, "Time to go play the costume." And now they started curling my hair. The first few episodes, yes, we tried to curl my hair. My hair does not take a curl. So they had a wig made. So what you're seeing is in fact a beautifully custom made, beautifully constructed wig. And gorgeous, but hurt like all get out. And we were just transported back to that time. We were all in costume, and for that day we were in the 1800s.
Sorry.
Oh my god, my childhood is a lie. Nellie Olson's ringlets are a wig.
I'm really sorry. Breaking news. Oh no. Anyway, I better rush on into these clips.
You do. You're in trouble if you don't. Go on. Get on.
Okay. Now, the really interesting thing when we were chatting was she was talking about the fact that the actress who played Laura,
Nellie Olson's ringlets are fake.
Stop.
Oh my god.
You won't sleep tonight, Philip. Anyway, they were great friends and they used to choreograph their own fight scenes and everything because they were so good. And there were amazing fight scenes. There's a lot of muck, a lot of Greek, a lot of all of that. But it's 50 years now since Little House on the Prairie first aired, not to age it too much or myself.
And, I was watching repeats.
Yeah. And it's still so, so popular, particularly with social media and everything. And there's an army of serious fans. So I asked Alison what life is like post-Prairie.
When the show ended, we all thought, well, that was a good run. You know, a bunch of actors. That was a good job. We'll all go on and do these other things. People became more obsessed with Little House as time went on. We had the VHS generation, the DVD generation, the cable. I mean, remember when we started the show, there wasn't even cable TV. We had no concept that everyone would, 50 years later, be streaming and people be watching it on their phones. No idea. This year's the 50th anniversary, and it's been bananas. Like, we have been doing, we had an event we partially produced with the Chamber of Commerce in Simi Valley. 18,000 people showed up over 3 days.
You're in the trenches of it.
Right.
The power of nostalgia. Amazing.
Or, as my husband likes to say, never underestimate the power of the Prairie. And it's been 50 years, but people, they get something out of it. It's a remembrance of their childhood. They feel connected to their past, often to their family. People say, I watched it with my grandmother, say, and I remember her. And there's something about it. It was a very emotional show. Most people aren't living in fancy places like Dallas and Dynasty and giant apartments like the people in Friends. They're living like Little House on the Prairie. They got a tiny place and a bunch of kids. That's how people live. And they can connect to it. And it's such an emotional show. It's about birth and death and life. And people, they connect to this on a really visceral level. Something about Little House, even our craziest fans are still sort of polite. I've met many people dressed as me. Halloween's big for people dressed as Nellie Olson. And the tattoos, you mentioned the tattoos. So the first one was a guy in France. He got Little House tattooed on his shoulder. And then he had me autograph it and had that tattooed in. Then I met a man in L.A. who had, and he, this whole section, the inside wrist there, that part of his lower part of his arm, the inside part, he had a huge tattoo, detail, incredible detail, of Nellie Olson, like a painting, which is really stunning. And he had me autograph it to go off to the autograph, the tattoo parlor, have the autograph tattooed into his skin. And then people started coming to the events and saying, please sign my arm, I'm heading to the tattoo parlor. Little House has that effect on people.
Oh my God, there's another absolute clanger. A lot of people loving this. A lot of people not happy with you.
Why?
Typified by Mags, who says, sorry, Brenda, but I was Laura.
No, I was Laura because I put on plays in my backyard or shed. Anyway, why was she here? As I said, she was here to speak at the Social Media Fest in Wexford, but she was here really to trace her Irish roots. And we got down to the brass tacks of it. So we left the lovely bar to go out into the grey, wet weather. And we went outside. Sorry, I'm starting to laugh again. Tullerone Graveyard. And we met Noreen Marr there. And she's from HibernianRoots.com. And she had been researching Alison's family tree. Now, her fourth great-great-great-grandfather, is that four, I said? I hope
I
so.
I wasn't counting.
You should. Is called Martin Bannon. And he left Tullerone for Canada in 1848. However, there is the most bizarre twist in this particular section of
what,
the tale.
What, he was wearing a wig with fake ringlets too?
Will you please take my report seriously? Anyway, here is Noreen and Alison, and we're at the gates. And Noreen, again, is the genealogist, and she's been tracing the roots. So we're going to see, can we find any of her relatives in the Tullerone graveyard?
Okay, well, I got some basic information from Alison about her great-grandfather being a great-great-grandfather coming from Tullerone. And I started looking into records and I found baptisms and I found brothers and sisters for him. So she's got cousins still living here in this area.
We're all related in this country. Noreen, yes. Alison, you got to share this wonder umbrella there.
So you go through my paperwork and then you say, oh, well, I have family from that area. This will be easy. I know the area. And then what happened?
Well, then I looked at some of her great-great-grandfather's siblings, and he had a sister called Anastasia, and she married my great-granduncle. So we're related by marriage.
I called home and said, well, you know, they've set me up this fabulous genealogist, but oh wait, now I'm related to the genealogist.
Do you know anything about Martin, her great-great-great-great-grandfather, like when he emigrated to Canada? What were his circumstances?
I only know that James Bannon, who's my
great-grandfather was born in Canada in, 1858?
Around the time of the famine. Yeah. So, you know, and he was from a big family, so it's more than like that some of the older brothers, you know, stayed on the farm and the sisters married locally. So a lot of the younger men in between then would have no option but to emigrate. Okay, so we'll go inside and we have found the grave of Martin's sister, Anastasia. She was born in 1820.
Are you excited, Alison?
I'm beyond excited. I've lost my mind some time ago in the car and I'm completely blithering hysterical. I love cemeteries. I love old cemeteries. And this is about as old a cemetery as you can get.
Noreen, where
okay,
are we at?
We're in the old section of the Tullerone graveyard, and the MacDonald grave, the Celtic cross there on the left, that's where Alison's great-great-grand-aunt is buried. That's the details over there, and my family is actually the grave in front of it. So we're very close.
All right. There it is. There's Anastasia, and there's name. It's absolutely mind-blowing.
The detail on the stone is very decorative. You can see the bunch of grapes and
the leaf thing.
Yeah, and the leaves.
It's very decorative. Celtic cross. That's a thing that we don't see in California. You know, my father died in 2009, so he didn't get to do this. And I mean, if he was alive, get him on the phone, he'd absolutely go mad that I was doing this. I can't believe I did it. I did it. I made it to Ireland, and I'm on my ancestor's grave.
Alison, would you like a moment on your own by the grave?
Yeah, give me just a couple seconds, a moment, because when does this ever happen to a person?
The genealogist turned out to be her relative. You see, if there had been that kind of plot twist in Little House on the Prairie, it might not have been so boring.
My goodness, you have no idea about the optimism and the despair that we love Little House on the Prairie. Anyway, so she found the grave of her great-great-great-by-four aunt Anastasia. But we had one more surprise for her. And luckily for me, we headed back into Shawnee's bar. And there, waiting to meet her, was a former All-Star Kilkenny hurler.
Before we let you go, we have one more surprise for you.
Oh, no, because I can't handle much more. I'm losing my mind. Yeah.
Because we have found your fourth cousin who is living
here. Shut up! You
who
did
is
not.
Living here.
Shut up!
And wait for it. He is a dairy farmer. This man is legendary in Kilkenny.
Shut up.
He is an All-Ireland hurling championship winner.
Sandy said that we have hurling champions.
He is an All-Star. He is from Tullerone. His son plays with the Kilkenny senior panel at the moment, but he is Liam Keoghan. Liam! Liam, can I introduce you to your fourth cousin? Alison!
I'm very excited to meet you. I'm Alison, all the way from Los Angeles. I'm pleased to meet you, cousin.
We have many
cousins in Canada who will be very excited about this. I've been keeping them apprised.
Well, you're welcome to Tullerone anyway. And
thank you.
Pity you didn't bring the sunshine with you.
Liam, you knew nothing about this till this morning. You're in as much a shock as Alison.
Got a phone call at 10 o'clock this morning to see what was I doing today.
Yeah.
All right, well, did you watch Little House on the Prairie?
We did years ago.
Do you feel weird that you're related to Nellie Olson?
It's a privilege to be related to a film star. Yeah, we loved it when we were children. We used to always watch it. And little did we think that we'd be meeting one of the stars.
Or you'd be related to one of the
related,
stars.
Related, yeah.
Wonderfully crazy.
So while Alison and Liam are facing off each other, really, and trying to figure out, are we actually alike? Noreen, can I ask you, have the family chart there. How are they fourth cousins?
Right, Liam's great-great-grand-aunt and Alison's great-great-grandfather were brother and sister.
That's crazy.
Well, we're closer than we thought.
Right? Well, what is your family and your friends going to say when you explain that your cousin's to Nellie Olson? Is that going to be weird?
Did I get a picture?
Oh, my God, you get anything you want, yeah?
Liam, you're going to have to explain hurling to Alison.
Well, we'll bring you to a match and you'll be blown away.
Yeah. Oh, no, this is huge. This is bucket list. My father passed away in 2009, so we didn't get to see this. He would be beside himself if he knew this. I have wanted to come to Ireland for decades. I do feel completely welcomed here. I do feel very much
like I have landed in the land of my family. And it's a very strange feeling, and I'm sure many Americans, they say this, but it's absolutely real, and I feel absolutely bonkers and excited about it. I am so excited, I cannot even tell you.
Cousin Liam, do you need a pint?
Well, we have a son at home milking, so yeah. We're okay. There's no rush home.
What a tonic.
What a twist.
Shut up! Shut up!
I have brought hurling to Little House in the Prairie. My work is done.
You've brought sunshine to everybody's life.
Oh, thank you very much.
Let's skip off down the grass-filled meadow. Brenda, goodbye. Thank you very much. Goodbye, everybody else. Lovely programme this morning. Tune in same time next week. Bye-bye.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.